Chats from the Blog Cabin.
This is your favorite time of the week with your number one podcast.
Come join Melissa and her guests on the Chats from the Blog Cabin podcast. From North Carolina, this podcast will have you feeling like you've known these folks for years. Listen in as they chat about life, culture, current events, and more, all with a special Southern flair. Curl up with your favorite beverage and get ready to be entertained. Tune in now for a unique experience that's fun and insightful.
Hi, y'all. Welcome back to another episode of Chats from the Blog Cabin. You know, the show where I virtually invite people into the blog cabin to chat about life. And today we are chatting about a topic that I know I personally have gone through, and that's maternal health with Dr. Allen. And I want to thank you for coming on the show and for being a guest. And before we get started talking about what you do, tell us a little about yourself.
Well, thank you very much, Melissa. It's a pleasure being here with you, and I'm so grateful for being asked. But I'm now 76 years old, just had a birthday. I've been an obstetrician for most of my adult life since 1977 when I graduated medical school, so quite a few years ago. Grew up on a small farm. No, they say you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. So I'm back in the country raising chickens, which is how I started out. And so I've made almost a full circle here, but had residency in St. Paul in Minneapolis. And I learned a lot. I had a wonderful program with great teachers. And I learned many things, I think, that other obstetricians probably don't get to learn. And that's what we're writing about now, and that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, when I was reading your stats and reading your bio and stuff, the thing that impressed me the most was you deliver 6,000 babies with no maternal mortalities. Now, that is an amazing feat.
Well, thank you so much. I do think that I'm not the only one who's done that, but, so I don't pretend to be, but I can tell you this. It's been fun. And a couple months ago, I ran into the head surgeon at the University of Minnesota on LinkedIn. And we had a little chat. And it turned out that we both talked about partnerships that you have with patients and how patient partnerships are really important as far as getting good results. Most moms I've found, and dads, will take care of themselves, but they need to know, first of all, they have permission to do so. And secondly, they need to know what that means. How do you take care of yourself? And I think that because they took care of themselves so well, they did not have any serious problems. You know, the number one problem today, cause of death for maternity, or childbearing related death, is what we call behavioral. In other words, suicide, homicide, and drug overdose. So I never had that. I never had any death for any reason. But again, I think it's because of the patient partnership.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I think a lot of women, because I love the fact that you wrote pregnancy your way, choose a safe and happy birth. But a lot of women feel like they have to go by what their doctor tells them instead of saying, hey, this is what I feel. This is the right plan for me. But they're like, the doctor's telling you one thing, but you're feeling another way. And your motherly instincts, even though it hasn't actually, you haven't actually become a mother yet, but your instincts are kicking in saying, no, there's something wrong, or no, I feel like we should do it this way. So why is it that important to have that conversation and to have that kind of doctor that will listen to you?
Well, of course, you do need to have somebody who will listen. And as a matter of fact, when we leave today, that's the message I would give. Find a provider who will listen to you. That's extremely important. That's the way you get into the patient partnership. And you can't denigrate or dismiss or in any way diss your patients. That doesn't work very well. You get bad outcomes that way. You know, NPR is full of bad outcomes. And if you read those, and you probably have, you'll see that the partnership has fallen apart. That's the cause of the trouble.
So what made you decide to write this book? Because I know a lot of women are probably saying, he's a man, what does he know about pregnancy, even though you have delivered 6,000 babies?
You know what? I know that. I'm old, I'm fat, I'm white, sometimes not very smart. But you know what? I've done this 6,000 times and with hundreds and thousands of visits. So I have gathered, I'm like an encyclopedia as far as listening to what moms and dads have to say. I've learned tremendous amounts from my patients. You know, there's an awful lot of providers, doctors, midwives, nurse practitioners, who think when they're done with residency that they have learned what there is to learn. And I can tell you this, most of what I learned in my life, I learned after my residency, and I learned by listening to my patients. You know, you find that 99% of people are good people, they're reasonable, they'll pretty much comply with the plan as long as they know what the plan is. And sometimes you have to adjust. For example, I had a mother come in with quads, 4 babies. And that was in vitro, and I didn't do that. It's considered a mistake. But what happens is the doctor wants to fix the mistake. Mm. So they recommend a reduction, which means that she'll wind up with 2 babies instead of 4. Well, she saw 4. I was the 4th doctor, and I was the only one who said, if you understand what these risks are and you want to take them, then let's go ahead and do it. But she smoked. And I said, you know, this is not, that's something that you're not going to be able to do during this pregnancy. And she said, I can't quit. I said, okay, fine, let's compromise. You smoke 1 cigarette a day. That way you win because you don't have to quit. And I win because 1 is less than 20. So you work out a compromise that's good for mom, good for babies, and what works for your doctor. So I could have had a tantrum and I could have read her the riot act, but I didn't. I said, okay, fine. You smoke 1 cigarette a day. And if you listen, we did this story with the quads. They're now 25 years old. And we had 3 girls and a boy. The boy, we've been invited to his wedding. But it's been fun. You know, all those years we get these Christmas cards and graduation cards. But that is because of that one day, that one decision that, yeah, we're going to get through this. I'm listening to you and we'll do this together. And so that video, by the way, is available. If you go to my Earl Doc Allen, it's available. So, and it's fun. Anyway, I've been talking too much. You have a question.
Yes, I do. What do you think? You were just saying how you like made the compromise with the mom. What do you think that most doctors aren't willing to make that compromise and saying, you have to do it this way. You have to do, you know, instead of only smoking 1 cigarette a day, you have to totally quit smoking. Why do you think most doctors are like so gung-ho on their opinion and making sure that everything is like by the book?
Well, I think there are many reasons for that, Melissa. But first of all, training, medical school and residency, those are not easy things. It is, and for the most part, you know, one of the things that we were told during residency, we can always replace you. So you're always kind of wondering how secure your position is. And in kind of a response to that, you think, well, I have to have my way. And that's also one of the things they teach you in medical school and residency is it's my way or the highway. So, yeah, when we're all done with our residency training, we come out thinking, you know, you are going to obey me or else. And a lot of doctors are also OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, before they get into medical school. Otherwise, they wouldn't even try to get through the process of medical school. So there's an awful lot of it's my way or the highway. But you know what? I was never that way as a human. I was not that way as a father, not that way as a doctor. And I think that people really buy into that relationship if you don't try to slam that down their throats.
That is so true. That's the reason why I was going to ask you. My next question was going to be, why did you take that different approach? Why was it that you weren't going to, you can take my advice or you can go somewhere else?
Well, in the first place, that's rude and cruel. Mm-hmm. But I've always been a mellow person. And so in that way, I'm not like the usual doctor, although there are a lot of doctors who think and feel, but there are also a lot that don't think and feel. And there's a whole lot that's happening in medicine today that keeps us from thinking and feeling and from establishing the relationship. And one of them is the medical record. You know, I'm sure you go to see a doctor sometimes and they probably have a medical record in front of them. I do too now. I go to the doctor sometimes. And I've got a good doctor, but he spends half of his time looking at the chart, looking at the record, and not looking at me. And when I was practicing a couple of years ago yet, I had to deal with the medical record. But I would deal with the record after the patient left, because eye contact is extremely important. And it's part of listening to people. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways you can keep that relationship and you can enjoy it. I always had fun. And I think part of being flexible and mellow is pragmatism. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, I'm a lot of things, but the biggest thing I am is pragmatic. I do what works. And I think people lose sight of that.
All right. We need to take a brief commercial break, but we'll be right back.
The threats women face today are unparalleled and even more dangerous than ever before. 1 in 3 women globally has been the victim of an assault. Women are terrified and they are looking for answers.
In the book, Street Smart Safety for Women, we draw on our experiences, both personal and professional, to provide those answers. It's by women, for women. Street Smart Safety for Women is available wherever books are sold.
And we are back talking with Dr. Allen, who has delivered 6,000 babies with no maternal mortality and also wrote the book, Pregnancy Your Way, Choose a Safe and Happy Birth. Now, in the book, you talk about a woman's flight plan for pregnancy. So can we talk about that?
Yes, thank you for asking that question, Melissa. It's one of the things that we tend to forget about is that we chop up healthcare. Fragmentation is a big problem. And, you know, we've got now the delivery plan that moms are supposed to fill out before they come to labor and delivery so that the nurses can kind of tell what is expected. But the flight plan goes way beyond that. The flight plan really is everything to do with pregnancy, from the first visit until infinity. You know, one of the problems we have in this country is that we have we get one postpartum visit, and that's at 12 weeks. And that is just totally inadequate. So what we've done with our flight plan and with our book is we are trying to make up for the things that don't work anymore in obstetrics. So the flight plan is really what do you want during this pregnancy and how are you going to get it? And in through all of that, there are things like safety and a good outcome that I have to kind of watch over. But like I said, it's been fun. I'm a pragmatist. I want to do things that work and listening and giving advice that people can tolerate. That's part of it. So that's what we try to do in the flight plan is more, it's more comprehensive. It's, and the other thing that I think is important is maternity care doesn't have to end at a year. It can go on forever.
That is very important because you talk about hormones and hormones fluctuate when you're pregnant, but even as a woman, your hormones are all over the place. And after you give birth, you have all those hormones. And I think we probably could catch a lot of postpartum depression cases if that continues after birth.
Well, you're right. There are tremendous amounts of hormone changes. Even just if you look at just what happens during labor, there's a lot of hormone activity. But actual labor or real labor really is a symphony of hormones. And sometimes, you know, when we interfere with that, like give Pitocin, you know, inductions, we change our symphony into cacophony. And so we're kind of running uphill a lot of times. So anyway, hormones are a big deal and are big hormone changes, but labor actually produces a whole bunch of feel-good hormones and hormones that get you started with breastfeeding and feeling good postpartum. So yeah, lots of hormone changes and some of them are a little precipitous. And yes, there are a lot of people who think that hormone changes contribute to postpartum depression.
Now, you just mentioned Pitocin. I will say I have three girls. They're all like in their 20s now. But I will say that the first and the last one, I had Pitocin because they weren't progressing. But my second one, I didn't have it. It was probably the easiest labor that I had, like literally within a couple of hours, she was out. So why is that? Why do doctors tend to go to the Pitocin route when it's not?
Well, you know, that's a big question. I'll try to answer it for you as quickly as possible. In the first place, doctors are trained to like Pitocin. And the reason for that is it's something we call rescindable. In other words, it's something that you can stop. The half-life of Pitocin is about 3 minutes. So if you stop giving the Pitocin IV, the effect of Pitocin should be basically gone in 4 or 5 minutes. So they like it. The other thing that we have is extremely, I think, unfortunate. And this is a belief that we are supposed to uphold. It's written, it's in almost like the Bible from the people who write our Bible, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. They love Pitocin. But the big problem is 24 hours. We have a lot of times with Pitocin comes a rupture of membranes. And that's totally not physiological. And we've got, once the bag is broken, we got a 24-hour rule. So we're behind the gun. So we have to start, our labor is focused, the focus changes from mom to the clock and to the insurance company. So we have to get that baby out of there within 24 hours. And I don't personally believe that. I have always felt, well, I'll give you an example. Years ago, back in 1980, I had a patient who came in, had a previous C-section only one baby, so no vaginal birth, but she wanted to try a vaginal birth. Well, at that time, we weren't supposed to give Pitocin to moms who had had a previous C-section. So I thought, okay, fine. I have to explain to the patient how we were departing from protocol and explain to her why we were departing from protocol. But as it turns out, she went into labor and she delivered totally on her own and totally within 24 hours. So You know, the 24-hour rule didn't really hit us. But my thinking, and I've had moms with ruptured membranes at 30 weeks, and what I do or have done with them, and it's worked every single time, I send them home. Mm. That way, nobody can get at them. In other words, the things that we do in the hospital that make people sick don't occur. And I think that's the reason they're so successful. And I've had a lot of people criticize me for that because, of course, the answer is that if I were taking a test, the answer would be, oh, she has to be hospitalized and then she has to have Pitocin. So, yeah, I've broken some rules, but I've never been sorry for it.
Well, that's the one thing is that you did it with a good conscience of saying that I know the outcome is going to be great. I just feel like the mom is going to be more comfortable at home. And when she progresses to come back in, instead of being hooked up and maybe told that she had to lay a certain way with a fetal monitor on her. And I mean, I've been through all that. So I understand that. And I applaud you for actually sending the moms home.
Well, you know, again, it's pragmatic. It works. And what I was protecting them from, and I'm sure I'm going to get a little flack from that, from what I'm about to say, and you might get flack too. But the main reason I didn't want them in the hospital is I did not want a bunch of pelvic exams. I've always thought the clock starts with the first pelvic exam. So, and there are doctors and nurses and mid-levels who do things to patients not necessarily for the benefit of the patient, but for the benefit of their own anxiety. In other words, when you have ruptured membranes at 30 weeks, there's absolutely no reason to start checking the cervix every day. And that's just foolishness. So I was protecting the patients from that, from these neuroses. I've always said to them, I've taught for many years, and one of the things I said to my students is, make sure you can answer this question. Are you doing this for your patient or are you doing this for yourself? And you better answer, I'm doing it for the patient.
I love that because a lot of doctors don't think about, they see the patient, but they don't actually see the patient as a person. It's more like, because it seems like the healthcare system is like a revolving door, like you next patient, and doctors don't spend the time to get to know their patients. So I love that.
Well, you know, I've always said that the fun part of this, these last 50 years, is knowing your patients. So, and that has made it fun, and I think has given good outcomes to most patients.
Now, in your 50 years of practice, what changes did you see that were amazing and you were like, great, we need to move forward? And what were some of the changes that you were like, why did they do this? If it wasn't broke, why fix it?
Well, unfortunately, the second group has more to it than the first. But let me say this, there has been some good changes. And one of the things, now, when I was a student back in the mid-70s, we used to give alcohol to mothers to stop labor, and they would get so incredibly drunk, and it would be so incredibly messy, and we don't even really know whether it worked or not, but I'd say by the end of the 70s, we had stopped doing that. So, yeah, that's a good thing. I'm happy for that. We've also changed our minds about giving Rogam. You know, we used to give it after delivery only, and then it had to be Rh positive baby, Rh negative mom. But we started giving Rogam during pregnancy, and I think that's a good thing because that way moms don't get sensitized during pregnancy. So that's good. We also started testing for group B. You know, in the mid-70s, when I was a student and resident, we didn't test for group B. There was no protocol for group B. Group B is a serious problem for babies. One of the things about babies is they're like old people. They're defenseless. Mm-hmm. So if a baby is very sick, they don't run a fever. What they do is they go to sleep. So you might think, oh my, this is baby's easy to take care of. Well, no, it's a baby that's on its way to the next life. So we've done good things, and I'm sure other good things too, pardon me. But I think in the long run, we've done more harm than good. And if you look at the death rate, the maternal death rate, in the late 80s and mid 90s, our maternal mortality rate in this country, the average, was about 8 per 100,000. Today, and when I say today, I'm meaning like 2021, 2020. The average rate is about 25 per 100,000. If you are Native American or Native Alaskan, it's about in the low 40s, like 42. If you are a woman of color, your maternal mortality rate is about 70 per 100,000. So we have come a long way in the very wrong direction. So this raises a bunch of questions. Why do we as a nation, why are we going in the wrong direction when every other country on the globe is going in the right direction? What are we doing? The other problem is discrimination. What's going on? Why do Black women have so much more trouble than white women? So the other big problem is insurances. Insurances start dictating healthcare. And I can give you an example of that. Years ago, when I was a student and resident, we would make rounds every morning and we would listen to the nurses and the patients, and we would decide whether they were ready to go home. In other words, our judgment was important, and our judgment came from listening to our patients. So if we thought the mother wasn't ready to go home on day three, we could keep them till day four, or for that matter, as long as we needed to get them ready. And when I say get ready, I mean the baby needs to be eating, the breast milk needs to come in, if that's the way it's going to work, if you're going to breastfeed. Baby should at least not be losing weight. And there should be a plan, that is, who's going to do what? Who's going to do the dishes? Who's going to wash the bathroom? Who's going to go grocery shopping? Who's going to cook? Who's going to get up with the baby at 3 a.m.? Needs to be a plan. And that's how you really avoid serious trouble when you go home, you know, postpartum depression. Today, we don't have that choice. Doctors don't get to decide when a patient is ready to go home. As a matter of fact, ready to go home isn't even part of the picture. But what we have instead is 20 CDs that we throw at patients that's supposed to take the place of the 3 or 4 days we had before to get the mom ready to go home. We know now that if you have a longer stay, like our C-section moms, 3 days, those babies at 6 months come in half as often with failure to thrive. Mm. So this has, you know, we have many costs that have many problems, and you know, the financial cost is one, but the cost of good health and good bonding and good baby care, that's a whole nother cost. And that's all part of when you take healthcare decisions away from the patient and away from the doctor. And we are doing that all the time. So there's, I think, great harm coming from those decisions that are made by the insurance companies, by their central, you know, our federal government, CMS, Medicare, Medicaid, that hurt the public.
I can see that because I can remember I had my girls in the 90s and 2000s, and I think that I had a couple of days in the hospital before I went home. But nowadays, it seems like as soon as somebody's having a baby, the next day they're out of the hospital. I'm like, how is that healthy for the mom? Because first she needs to recover from the trauma that her body has gone through with the labor. I mean, I just want someone to go through labor. These people in an insurance company that are dictating all this, I want them to go through labor just one time and realize that maybe they got it wrong.
Well, you're right. I mean, they should experience this, and of course they never will. It's kind of like the, you know, if you go to England and look at the kind of care that the princess gets and the kind of care that the king gets, they don't go to the National Health Service. They go to a private hospital. So what they're doing is they are escaping the controls that apply to most of their subjects. So, yeah, we, in this country, we can have similar things. For example, I know I have Medicare, but I also have another insurance. And I'm not so stupid as to think that Medicare is going to take care of me, but I am smart enough to know that I better have another insurance. So, yeah, it's a insurance is a real complicated thing. The other thing, and we've talked about this before today, is the medical record. It is just a nightmare. If you have a 15-minute visit, 10 minutes of that will go to the electronic record and 5 minutes will go to the patient. And of course, when insurances cut their pay, they increase their prior authorization, which is a whole nother nightmare. When they do that, they take away, again, care from the patient. And the CEO, many of us are now employed. The CEOs say, oh, well, you can't spend all that time with that patient. You have to produce. And you can't let them ask you two questions. You can only let them ask you one question. So there's a whole lot of things that are kind of ganging up against good medical care and against the best interest of the patient.
Now, let's say, for instance, that a woman is just finds out she's pregnant, but they don't have like an OBGYN that they normally go to. What are some of the questions that they should ask to find the one that fits right for them, not just to go off to somebody else's recommendation or go in the yellow pages and look up somebody?
Well, you know, it's hard to find a doctor today because everybody is getting fragmented. In other words, the visits, the weekly or monthly or weekly visits, however many, they'll probably be done by a nurse practitioner. You may see a doctor at the time of delivery. On the other hand, you may find that you've got what they call the doc on deck, which is a doctor that happens to be there for the 24 hours that they're on call. So there is that wedge between the doctor and the patient.
So what questions should they go in asking, though, to make sure that they're at least in the right practice?
Okay. The thing that you have to ask or you have to think about is visiting a number of doctors. For example, when I was practicing, I would allow people to come in. They'd tell me their doctor shopping. I'd say, fine, you know, I'm your third visit or I'm the third doctor you've seen. If you don't like me, don't come back. I didn't say it quite that way, but, you know, they weren't obliged. But usually if we sat down and talked, and that's my point, they would come and they'd say, fine, you're our last step. And that's what the Quads people said. You're the last doctor we're going to see. So yes, you can doctor shop. So that's one thing. The other thing is, who am I going to see on my visits? Am I going to see you? Who am I going to see for delivery? And am I going to see you? Or, you know, who else might I see? They probably would get angry with you if you asked them their C-section rate, but you might try that. You're not going to find out how many moms have died. You're not. I wouldn't. I mean, that's a real difficult question to ask. It's going to put everybody on their knees or heels, rather. But and there's really no way to know that either, you know. But I can tell you this: if you know that there's been one death, I would think twice. If you know there's been two, three, or four, I would think lots of times. That would not be on my list. One of the things that we talk about is word of mouth. And that's one of the things you brought up too, is word of mouth. You could probably expect, you know, if you have three friends who've had good outcomes, you can probably expect the same good outcome for yourself. So those are some of the questions you can ask.
Yeah, I know when I was pregnant with all three of my girls, I went to the same practice, but we never knew who was going to be there to deliver them when they, but at least during the time that I was pregnant, I got to see all the doctors in the rotation. So I kind of knew who I wanted and who I didn't want at the time. So I think that's one of the great things that practices are doing now, is they're rotating the doctors out instead of seeing that one particular doctor.
I think you're right. I think there has been that for a long time in a group practice. For the most part, I've been solo. So they saw me every time and they got me for the delivery. And I think I probably missed three deliveries in my life. So, no, years ago, when my kids were young, we took off in January to go skiing. I had a bunch of deliveries before I left. I was gone for 10 days, got back. Nobody had delivered, but I had six moms in labor.
Well, it must have taken a toll on you as well, because you think about it, if you're the only doctor and they're going and they're delivering, like there could be some moms that were delivering at the same time. So you were running back and forth between the two.
Well, that's exactly what happened, because we had three hospitals at the time. And I think there were two in each hospital. So you know, the first thing I did was to run around to all the hospitals and try to make sure that I knew what was happening, and actually I didn't miss any of them.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Now, let's talk about bone health, because that's something that a lot of women struggle with, is you know, osteoporosis and bone health. So what can we do?
Well, let me say this. It is a really big problem. And I'm going to start at the back end. Women are a little bit more at risk because they have menopause before men have their andropause. So, you know, many women will be without estrogen. Estradiol is the hormone we're talking about, by the age of 50, whereas men are more likely to run out at 75 or 80. So there's a big difference. So women are at higher risk. Which women are at most risk? Well, those happen to be women who are thin, white, and smoke. Mm-hmm. So naturally, you can stop smoking anytime, and that will help, because smoking raises cane with estrogen. So yeah, quit smoking. The other thing that protects women is activity. So if you can keep your activity, and it doesn't even have to be terrible. I mean, you don't have to go play volleyball every day or tennis or whatever else you might be thinking of. Walking is good exercise. So once you're through, you know, with the lifestyle things and the inevitable hormone changes, then what do? Most hormone treatment for osteoporosis works by keeping old bone. In other words, you know, we think that bone is you think of it like a, wooden plank or a wooden post or something that isn't alive. But bone is very active, and that's it's active not only in the inside, the marrow, but the outside of the bone is also active, and it is composed, it has a balance of the bones that are being built and the bones that are being removed. Most hormone treatments for osteoporosis work on this part, the bones that are being removed. It slows down that. So you wind up with retention of old bone, but it does seem to help, although there are complications. You know, you probably have heard about the trouble with the jaw, the necrosis of the jawbone, which you really don't want to have. There are other problems. There is a shot that you can get twice a year. I think it probably costs a couple $1,000s, but it probably is an easy way to take the stuff. But one of the really big problems is low calcium, and low calcium can itself cause a lot of trouble. So, you know, there's a warning on it that says don't give it if your calcium is low, but what you don't know is if you do give it, will it drop your calcium to the floor? So you don't really know. I guess my advice to moms, be active while you can. Don't smoke. And, you know, if you're 5'6", don't weigh 100 pounds. As a matter of fact, you know, we know for both men and women, if you're a little bit overweight as you get older, you're healthier. So, yeah, us fat people do better.
So next time the doctor tells you you need to lose some weight, you're like, what?
Tell your doctor to go to hell.
So let's talk about informed consent as well. What exactly is that?
Well, you know, there's many pieces to informed consent, but certainly the big one is autonomy. That is, what does the patient want? So, you know, years ago, autonomy didn't mean anything. And we can go back to the lady with the cigarette. You know, one cigarette a day was my concession to her autonomy. There are doctors who will take away your autonomy without batting an eye. And, you know, one of the problems we have today, take Medicare Advantage, which, of course, I hate. It's now 52% of Medicare eligible people are on Medicare Advantage. But they very heavily regulate where you go. And to my way of thinking, that is a violation, extreme violation of the most important part of informed consent, which is, can I choose the doctor I want to see? That's the beginning of autonomy. And it's the first thing they take away from you. So autonomy is really important. You have to, the patient really has, the other thing is they have to understand, you know, choice has to be in there too. That's one of the reasons we have that in our book title, Choose a Safe and Healthy Birth, indicating that you do have autonomy, you can make the choices. So that's the most important part, I think, of informed consent. But you really have to be careful. I'll give you an example of kind of backwards informed consent. Years ago, there was a doctor who was sued because a patient had developed melanoma. But the history is that she had seen him yearly for 3 years. And he had advised her to have the thing on her leg biopsied, and she didn't get it done. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, she sued him when she finally found out, and she won. And the reason she won is that he didn't inform her of the consequences of not doing what he said. Mm-hmm. So there's that part of it too. In other words, the patients need to know, if you don't take my advice, what are the consequences?
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to hit on something you just said about informed consent, about having the right to choose your own doctor. Do you think that actually adds to the mortality rate for women?
You know, you're asking an old biased man, so I'm going to say yes. I think it does make a difference. Again, we're going to go back to one of the first things we talked about was the patient partnership. You know, if you are forced to go to a doctor you don't like, there's no partnership. Mm-hmm. And the partnership is what makes a good outcome. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think it is a problem. And you know, there are doctors who either don't want to listen, or they don't have the time to listen, or they have the it's my way or the highway thing. So there's a lot of reasons that people disconnect. But certainly, I think if you never get the right to choose in the first place, that's a problem.
So how do we go about fixing that problem?
Well, I tell you what. The problem was legislated in, and it needs to be legislated out. And that's the only way it's going to work. But good luck with that. You know, I mean, there's an awful lot of lobbyists in Washington, D.C., you know, like I recently looked at a YouTube, and the person described the Senate as a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, there's a whole lot of people there who are older than I am.
Yep.
And I'd like to think that I don't need to be in a nursing home yet, but I do think that this is going to be a real big problem, trying to put autonomy back into the public and into the insurance companies, because that is the first thing they do. You know, this has been coming along for many years. That is, mm-hmm. Treating patients like chattel, like property. And that's actually what happens behind closed doors. And it gets to be, oh, well, you know, you don't own this patient. You know, mm-hmm. It really gets to be a big problem. As a matter of fact, there was a doctor punished severely for seeing a patient who was in one insurance group. And she went to see another doctor, which she was allowed to do. But the other doctor ordered one test, which he wasn't supposed to order. Mm. So he was reprimanded for stealing this patient one time. So patients are, you know, victimized by this, and so are providers.
I love the fact that you said patients and providers, because a lot of times I think the doctors really don't have a choice. They have to go by what the insurance company says and by what legislation says. So I like the way you said that.
Well, thank you. Yes, I would say that there is something called direct primary care. And that is where a doctor remains pretty much out of the insurance realm. And what they need is about 500 patients, and they need from each patient about $80 a month. And for that, they get all their lab tests at cost, mm-hmm. all their medications at cost. They can be seen the day or so after they call, and they can call at any time of the day or night. It's a really good thing for patients, but guess what? insurance companies hate it. And of course, insurance companies can buy lots of lobbyists. Mm-hmm. They have lots of money. You know, CVS just bought Aetna a couple of years ago, $75 billion. So mm-hmm. where did CVS get that money? Well, from the public, yeah. from you, from me. Anyway, there's a lot of money and that can go to lobbyists and buy our legislators. But this is what happens. The reasons that these things are outlawed, we are accused, or those direct primary care doctors are accused of offering or of being insurance agents. So that's mm-hmm. how this gets to be illegal. Well, that's just a matter of opinion. It could easily be changed by legislators who cared about the public.
Yeah, that is so true. Now, Dr. Allen, our time is almost up. Is there one last little nugget before we talk about where people can find you at that you would like to either stress, something that we've talked about or something we haven't hit on yet?
Well, there's, you know, too much to talk about, but one thing we haven't talked about is preeclampsia. And the thing is with preeclampsia is, and if you have preeclampsia, the complication is eclampsia, which is a seizure. I haven't had any moms ever have a seizure. And the reason is I have always had my patients take care of themselves at home. So again, this goes back to the patient partnership. And that's the fun part of being a healthcare provider.
I love that, the patient partnership and the fun part, because a lot of, like you said, doctors are so stressed because they have to get the quota. They have to see so many patients. And one of the things that I loved about my girl's pediatrician was she took the time, even if she was running late and we would be there later, she always took the time to answer every question that we had. And I think that's what we need more about more doctors now.
Most patients don't mind waiting if, when they get in to their provider, they actually get a chance to sit down, talk, ask their questions, and get their answers.
Yep, for sure. So where can people find you at?
The best way is Rural Doc Allen. And of course, you've got it there. Thank you very much. And that'll get you to everything else that has some value. We are redoing the depression part of our book. As a matter of fact, I'm redoing it now because I think it is actually the worst chapter of our book, although I meant it to be the best chapter. So we're going to do a whole new book on postpartum depression. It's coming out hopefully at the end of the summer.
Oh, wow. And where can people find your book, Pregnancy Your Way?
It would be Amazon, and that's Pregnancy Your Way. And it's Amazon. You got it there. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And Dr. Allen, thank you for coming on. And when you redo and talk about postpartum depression, I would love to have you come on and chat about that, because I think that's something that a lot of people don't talk about.
Well, you're right, because a lot of people don't know about it. But this is the message I would love to leave. Postpartum depression is preventable. And that's going to be the name of the book. And I'm going to get a lot of flack about that.
I can't imagine you will. So once again, guys, Dr. Allen, thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your wisdom and guiding us through this. Because I wish I had someone like you when I was going through my pregnancies.
Well, I certainly appreciate it, Melissa. It's a wonderful opportunity to be with you here today. And hopefully your audience has learned a little bit about something from this old fat man.
I love that. So guys, I will put in the show notes everywhere where you can find Dr. Allen, as well as finding his book. And I see he has another book right behind him, so I will also link that book as well. Because when I went to go grab the Amazon link, I saw the other book, Modern Medicine, up there. So I'm going to grab that as well. And once again, Dr. Allen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. I really appreciate it. It's my pleasure.
All right. Bye, guys.
Chats from the Blog Cabin. It's
subscribe, and don't miss the next episode.